Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I bring what I feel is really the latest cutting edge of spiritual movement that's happening in this country and around the world. And tonight's guest is very much in alignment with this unfolding of a higher potential in us. He is Dr. Gerald Epstein, and he'll be one of the featured speakers on Thursday night, December 18th. On the subject of physical immortality, and we'll be talking about that and also his work as an integrative healthcare practitioner and a therapist and someone who's knows how to send imagery, mental imagery, as a form of healing. So, Jerry, are you with me?
I sure am.
Okay, good. First, let's talk a little bit about the other evening, and then we can get into your history. The idea of physical immortality, which most people don't consider an actuality, how did it come to you that that was something that was possible?
Well, I first started on that particular aspect of immortality, in which I'm interested in the whole field, but the physical part came to me through the work of a person I found to be instrumental in my understanding, named Robert Rondell Gibson. And he elucidated something called what we would call the physiology of life and death. And taking off from that, it became clear that given that you would take it upon yourself to reverse the responses that you have to your life situation, you could reverse your physiology. It's based on the understanding that your mental life, physical life, emotional life, social life, moral life are all one. So if you are taking care of one aspect of your life, the other aspects will follow in turn and remain in health.
But how do you reverse your physiology? What's an example of doing that?
Oh, anything is whenever you are taking a, let's say the basis for this work is what we call the emergency state. And we regard emergencies as anything that we perceive as an acute threat to us in some way. You see what's going on now with the economic issues, and people are perceiving it as an acute threat to their existence. So
right.
they're projecting into a time, place, and circumstance called the future, which doesn't exist. It's an illusion. But they project and treat that as though it's right now. So they feel
so
alive.
They're living in the future, and they're not living in the present, and therefore it ages their body?
It ages your body because it elicits a response physiologically in your system called fight or flight. And whether the emergency is true or false, you'll go into a fight-or-flight response. And in that fight-or-flight, your body creates an enormous amount of chemical substances that you pour into your system to prepare for and to gear up for the emergency to take care of the fight-or-flight.
Right, because that's how we survive in those critical situations, and
yes, but
the body goes into a different mode of operating, and it's supposed to only be, you know, in an emergency. Very occasionally in the life of an animal does it need to actually go into that.
Well, in the case of a human being, it's extraordinarily rare that you would find an emergency that you would face that's a true emergency, that right now your life is on the line. We could think of several instances like that that may have happened to some people, but by and large, to most everybody, you have not faced a true emergency where your life was frankly online, which you could say the model would be a gun to your head and somebody's about to pull the trigger and blow your brains out.
Mm-hmm.
So taking it as a...
But you're saying most people live as if that was going on. They have money, they lose in the stock market,
and they act as if that's a gun to their head, and they project into the future about what's going to happen to them.
And what happens
to their
body?
In either case, whether it's true or not, your body is responding in exactly the same way by fight or flight.
And what happens in the body with...
All the chemical substances that are poured into the system begin to accumulate, and if you have a true outlet, if it's a true emergency, you'll be able to rid yourself of all of those chemical elements, the pituitary hormones and the adrenal hormones and the insulin and the glycogen from the liver and the thyroid hormone and the lactic acid from the muscle tension. All that kind of stuff is poured into the system, and you'll be able to get rid of it, because it's been there to prepare you for the emergency. If it's a false emergency, there's no outlet.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that breaks down.
Right.
You begin to feel uneasy, and when it breaks down in your body, it becomes a poison. And those poisons have to be eliminated. So you call upon various systems of your body to eliminate those poisons, like the immune system, the lymphatic system. You begin, urinating and defecating and sweating, and nausea and vomiting, and all kinds of things are happening as cleansing responses to get rid of all these poisons. And if you keep responding habitually to situations as if they are here now, when they're really projections into a time, place, and circumstance that doesn't exist, you'll keep creating emergency states for which you're calling on the systems in your body to get rid of the stuff.
But that's not the only thing that ages our body. Is it? That's not the only thing that ages our body.
It's the major thing that ages your body. It's by far the major thing. It's called stressors and shocks and things of that nature that definitely respond to as though it is an acute threat to your existence, and you act as if there is one. Well, what happens is that over time, the systems will begin to age and break down. Because you're calling on them and you're taxing them, and the natural response to come to balance and the cellular responses that help you get rid of the poisons will soon be taxed as well and overused. And aging occurs and the systems begin to decay, and that decay is the beginning stage of the decomposition of us, and we begin to age and break down. And that decomposition and decay comes as a consequence of the emergency states that are false.
So is there any way to reverse this, though, once it's happened?
Of course you reverse it, because you must respond to the emergency states in an appropriate manner. Most of them, false emergencies, are functions of misconceptions and misperceptions you have about life. Mm-hmm. And so you misconceive the situation as though it's an acute threat and your life is at stake. And you
How do we undo the conditions that have already stressed us?
Well, you begin to step back. Instead of being swept up by the experience and looking at the world from inside out, you start to look at your experience from outside in.
Mm-hmm.
So you step back and you become an observer of the situation, and you ask yourself a question. Is this a true or false emergency? You have to be honest and frank about it, understanding that the gun to the head model represents a true emergency, your life is at stake at this moment. If the answer is, no, my life is not at stake at this moment, well, now you have a leg up on the situation, because you are saying, essentially, oh, there's no true emergency here, and the emotional states of anxiety, fear, worry, and so on are the fuel that is stoking these untruths, which is the projection into the future, which doesn't exist. So once you observe that from a distance, and you take that into account yourself, it's a very simple way to stop the emergency state, the false emergency. And if you do that, nothing of what I mentioned begins to happen. There's no overtaxing of the system. There are no poisons. There's no output of the metabolism. The poisons are stopped. You're reversing your physiology. And when you reverse your physiology, you're living. You're not decaying.
But if you do have your life savings in the stock market, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and suddenly you lose it all, it is an emergency. You won't be able to feed your family. You won't,
Who says so? That's stories that are made up. There are always resources that become available for everybody to be able to fall back on and use. You're never left to starve to death unless you don't take advantage of the resources that are there. And if you buy into yourself that this is the end of the road for me and my life is over, then you are creating a belief and a misconception that there's going to be an end to my life, that there's nothing more I can do.
Right.
And once you start futurizing that way, you're incurring an emergency response in yourself. And when you don't do that, you see yourself being fed and see yourself, let's say, in a wheat field, and you're collecting the wheat and you go into your kitchen and you bake bread, imaginally as an example, things begin to happen. The universe begins to set in and help you. Remember, we're talking about an alliance that you're setting up with the invisible universe, with the invisible world. And,
go through that again. So if I'm needing some extra resources, I create the mental imagery of going into a kitchen and baking bread, because that's a kind of symbolic gesture.
You are discovering a new possibility, and a new belief is held in this image that resources are available for you. What you believe, what you conceive, you'll birth. So when you conceive it, the universe begins to come to your aid and your assistance.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're making, and this is a show about your spiritual life, and we're talking about how you approach your life circumstance from a point of view of spirit. And in the spiritual direction, you are making contact and an alliance with the invisible universe and the invisible, the celestial world, the divine world, the world of consciousness. You're putting yourself in connection with that world, which is an endless resource of sustenance and help, and it comes your way. And so that's what happens. That's how it works. So you don't get swept away in the sea of fear and tumult and turmoil that is generated by the false emergency. You separate yourself from it, and you create a space, a distance, and you distance yourself from it because you're not from the inside looking out, but from the outside looking in, and you've created a distance, and that space is where something new can come to you, where something new is created. That's a spiritual point that is understood. The universe comes to serve you. You're served in this situation.
The other thing that you were saying about aging and stress is that animals seem to get old, and they don't have a lot of stress usually. So what?
Of course they have stress. They're always the predators and the prey. They're always being hunted. And,
what about house pets? You know,
And even in the animal groups that are the predators, like the wolves, there are packs of wolves that pounce on each other. There are territory disputes and fights. That's always going on in the animal community. There's an endless fight within within their systems about survival, and we kind of replicate that to some degree by buying into the notion that the life on Earth is one of natural selection and survival of the fittest. So we have to therefore always take advantage of what's available to us, and also if we can dominate and subjugate others, they become less of a threat to overtake us, and that helps us extend our lives. So that's kind of the game of power is control. What I'm talking to you about is the game we call power is freedom, and that's
where
you access your own source of freedom that's available to you. You become aware, you make choices consciously, you act intentionally, and you involve yourself in creating change. You do that for yourself because you are the author of your own freedom. So you are able to do that by taking that step and reversing your attachments to these misconceptions that tend to rule our lives through the conditioning that's happened to us since we're young. So we're reversing our relationship to the world, and we are taking a step back and turning around from all of those faulty belief systems that have been inculcated in us and that we've been conditioned to. And the emergency states are one of the major culprits about that is the false emergencies that we have responded to with anxiety and fear and so on, and all of those distressing emotional states are always about the future, except, you know, might be guilt and remorse and regret, which are about the past. But neither of the past nor the future are in truth. The past is over, dead, ended, gone, buried, finished, and the future doesn't exist. It's an illusion. So
Do you ever get caught in the illusion sometimes? Do you forget, or are you always on?
Well, look, you know, my practice has been, look, I've worked in my lifetime, the bulk of my adult life, to practice this way that I've been talking about.
Right.
So I'm not overwhelmed by the circumstances. I'm not a victim, if you will, of circumstances. I'm not determined by what the circumstances are around me. I'm well aware that the circumstances don't determine me, and that I'm not responding to what you say, think, or do. So I don't put myself in a slave position to be at the behest of the circumstances or of others' impositions on me. I work diligently to maintain my own authority.
Unknown factor in the universe where we are co-creating this reality with the universe itself, right?
So well, of course. Well, in the tradition which I follow, it says we're made in the image and likeness of God.
Mm-hmm.
So that means we're born to be co-creators. So we're here to emulate God by making ourselves available to create a space for new possibilities to come into our lives, so that we don't respond in this conditioned, habitual way, which is what the false emergency state is. It's a function of habituation, and then it's not true. And our interest is discerning what's true from what's not true. And what's not true is futurizing, is talk about the future. It's not true. So we're here on the horizontal plane to look at and discern what's true from what's not true.
So what is true? So only the moment is true. What we're feeling.
Exactly. What is? What is now?
That's the only thing that's true.
That's the only thing that's true. Anything else you want to say about it is a distortion and discoloration of it, and you're distorting it by making up a story about what the future is going to bring to you. That's a story about something that doesn't exist. So
but
you're involving yourself.
You know, you make up a story, you create these images, getting back to the image area. And so you make up a story, you create these images that create a further deterioration, because the image only exists in the present, and that's part of your work with imagery, is to bring something into the present.
It's a reverse of ordinary thinking. It's a reverse thinking process. So you're not
going to that. How is imagery a reverse thinking process?
Because it's an acausal way of thinking, and it's not cause and effect thinking. You're making a discovery of what is that you are perceiving in the inner form of consciousness. So in the inner form, you're perceiving the natural and true language of the mind, which is image. So it's reverse.
Take that a little slower. I just want to follow. If you tell me to think of an image.
See an image of such and such.
But I'm reacting to what you're telling me. It's like, you know, I'm following your directions in that sense. And so it's not coming from nowhere. It's coming from a source, from you. And
I'm jump-starting you to teach you the process. But then you take it on yourself to make your own discoveries. Because I want you to be free. I want you to be free.
What's the process of making our own discoveries? Talk about how that works.
You simply ask yourself, one simple way is to ask yourself for an image of, listen, if you're feeling angry, ask yourself, what does the anger look like? And an image will come spontaneously to you about what it looks like, and then you do something to correct it, to reverse it. So
what would that be? What could I do to reverse
that? Well, for example, somebody who I said, what does the image look like? And this person said, I see flames in front of me. Mm-hmm. So I said, enter into the flames wearing an asbestos suit, and a rain shower comes from above and douses the flames. Okay. How do you feel? How do you feel? And the person says, the anger is gone. For that moment, you've acted in a way to remove the distressing feeling. Mm-hmm. And you've done that by an inner process, accessing your own power to create change. And that you acted intentionally, and you made a choice, and you became aware of something in the inner form of consciousness that you hadn't been educated to that exists. Mm-hmm. So you're using yourself as the agent of change. You're not dependent on the world for them to give you something so that you can change. You're taking it upon yourself, and you're becoming your own authority. And that's the key to spiritual practice and spiritual life. So the circumstances are not the determining factor of you. They don't define you. You're not defined by something else that you attach to. Mm-hmm. You know, and the Buddha said, for example, life is suffering, life is attachment. Suffering and attachment, that is this involuntary conditioned suffering, is a process of attaching to things and being dependent on those things that you attach to and becoming, in certain cases, what the attachments are named. So mm-hmm. if somebody says you have cancer, then you become that. Whatever you're named, you become, and you become attached to it. And you
will always. How do we get over the attachment? By reversing
yourself and detaching from it. So you detach from all those things in your life that you are been afraid to remove yourself from, many of which you hold dear, like your own ideas or beliefs or relationships, and you renounce those and you make a reversing. You create a space between yourself and it. And in that space...
Well, if I'm attached to like a person or an idea, what do I exactly do to unattach? What, like, I, you know, want to be with this person and I'm just attached, and how do I undo that?
You can do an exercise. Let's say one prominent exercise we do to gain new feeling states and new possibilities for yourself is what we call a stopping exercise. So, you know, your relationship to somebody, you hold on to it because you feel you need it. And what we feel we need is always there. When we don't need something, it disappears. So we feel we need it because we're depending on that person for our happiness, for our well-being, or for whatever other reason that we attach. So we hold on to the relationship, although we realize that it's not serving us as something that's helping to promote movement and life in ourselves. So you want to stop this attachment, right? One exercise that really works beautifully, that anybody can try, is to stop at a red light and wait until the red light changes to green before you cross the street, no matter what the condition is, because you may be on a street where there's a red light and there are no cars coming and there's no obstruction to your crossing against the light. But you wait, and you wait until the light turns green, and then you cross. And then you come to the next red light, you stop. And you wait till it turns green. And you keep that practice going and see what happens, because you'll find that you'll impulsively cross against the light. You can't wait. So you can't... Right. That waiting, that inability to wait is an attachment. So
I see. Attachment to just my... Attachment to whatever, you see.
To my need to get across the street. And to get somewhere and so on. So I always have an attachment to something, and that's the source of the suffering, because these attachments are really making me enslaved, and I'm making these attachments important. And whatever I make important, I become enslaved to. Mm-hmm. So now I'm reversing the attachment, and I'm detaching myself. I'm disengaging. I'm making a space.
But you also said you are in control of your life in a way through the power you've gained. But isn't that also an attachment in a sense?
No, but for that now when you detach on the horizontal plane, there is an urge in us to attach, as I've been defining. There's an urge to attach. We're conditioned to attach. There's a wish to attach. So where do I attach? I attach to the vertical plane. I attach to my relationship and alliance to the invisible world in whatever way I want to define it. So whatever way I want to call that invisible world, I attach there. That's where my interest is. not attachments to the material world. I attached upward. So a detachment here leads me to attachment there. I remain rooted to the visible. I remain rooted in the horizontal world, so I don't fly away, but I live in it, but not of it. So I'm not swept away by the turmoil and the torrential sea of disturbance that's going on around me, the circumstances. Mm-hmm. So my attachment is there, is up, while I'm remaining with some roots here.
Right, right, right. And doesn't the vertical world, in some sense, become the horizontal world in some abstract
well,
sort of way?
You become attached to it, and you seek your fulfillment in that direction, in the non-material in the non-material world. That's where.
And
you
it's okay to become attached to the non-material world. You're saying that
well,
isn't that another attachment?
It's spiritual life. It's the
right.
way spiritual life works. That there's a urge in us to worship, to attach, to make ourselves subordinate in some way to some authority.
Mm-hmm.
And so that authority that we bow to, so to speak, is that vertical one,
mm-hmm.
not to another human on the horizontal plane. We don't
right.
want to do that at all because that's enslavement. And
right.
we make idolatry that. Yeah.
But to also to come full circle, we talk about physical immortality, which I'm open to, but is that an attachment to the body in
not
the horizontal way?
You're simply reversing your physiology. Because if you stop the emergency state, the false emergency state, there's no decay. You don't decay. I've offered you an anatomical, physiological, incontrovertible truth. Because the physiology that I've described and the anatomy that goes on about the systems clearing everything out is an indisputable anatomical physiological truth that everybody in the world is constituted this way in the time-space existence. Nobody can dispute what I just said. So if there's a movement toward decay, there has to be a reverse movement against this entropy, this breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
The words that have come to define this is called negentropy, which is the reverse, going into greater organization and complexity, or ectropy, ECTROPY, so that you're...
The reverse of entropy, yeah.
Reverse of entropy. Since we have, we've taken the choice to become entropic, we can take the choice to become negentropic. We're born with free will and choice. We can choose one way or the other.
Okay, so I think you just cleared something up for me. The goal of immortality is not an attachment to the body. It's a kind of purity of spirit in body that can live on the earth.
Exactly. So
okay.
you're creating a resurrective body or a essence body or a soul body and or an immortal body, which is a natural consequence of reversing the emergency state that we're talking about. So your
physiology. Well, have you known people who have done
this?
Excuse me? No, I'm just wondering if you've met anyone who's been able.
Well, that's what I teach. That's what I teach here. I know. I have my school here in New York, and I have my classes for the public, and I have a training center for healthcare professionals authorized by New York State, and you can find my books, Healing Visualizations, and the CD set, Natural Laws of Self-Healing, and the Phoenix Process, and Kabbalah for Inner Peace, and Healing into Immortality, and all kinds of writings that I've done. And my website is drjerryepstein.org.
Right.
Jerry
and
with
Jerry
a J.
Will be talking with Leonard Orr on Thursday night, another person who's very much into immortality, who's met the immortal yogi Babaji, and has his approach, actually, just to let you know, he says we have to break the death urge, this conditioning about...
Well, that's what I'm talking about, because in our tradition, it's been placed very simply. It says in Deuteronomy, I set before you, God says, I set before you at every moment life and death, good and evil. Choose. It's a fantastic statement, because it's giving you an option. You can choose the death way or you can choose the life way. I'm teaching you how to choose the life way.
But we're unconsciously conditioned in the other way. We have to make ourselves conscious
of it. So you become conscious of it, and so instead of involving yourself in the involuntary suffering, you now become what you bring to yourself is voluntary suffering by reversing all these attachments that you've held dear, and you feel have defined who you are and what you are.
Oh, okay, wait, that's a good point. So instead of the involuntary reaction, we voluntarily suffer by releasing the attachments that we have. That's interesting.
And that's going to come with pain, and we call that growing pains, and not the destructive pain of the involuntary suffering, which is the conditioned reflexive responses, the mechanical
responses. Well, what kind
responses
of attachment? What do we let go of? Which kind of attachments are you talking about? To what?
Your habits, your addictive habits, your conflicted relational habits, people that you may be connected to who are dwelling in false belief systems and are constantly getting themselves into difficulties and so on, and you're taking yourself out of those systems, which includes, for many people, the family systems, which are based on false beliefs.
False beliefs are family systems based on?
Well, you know that it's natural to feel anxious about your son goes out or daughter
right.
goes out on a date, and you're worried about her safety and whether she'll be home in time and so on and so forth, and then you call
right.
while she's out to find out how she is, and you know and so on, and then you create this dependency of the of the parent-child relationship and so
right.
on.
What do you do? Your daughter goes on a date, and you don't worry. And what do? You
no,
let it go.
No. Yes. Yes.
You do.
Yes. So.
Okay.
So I trust, and the my belief is that everything is turning out fine, and I trust the invisible world, and I do, have a sense. I know where she's going. I know where she's. What she's attending, and so on, and so I know what the overall, what sort of the general scheme of what she's doing, and what she does, she does.
I get it. So you just let go and you trust. But let's get back to this.
I've also taught her about
yeah.
some of these matters, as I do my son, because our tradition says you must teach your children the story of freedom. You have to teach them how to be free. That's what the job is of parents, to teach the children how to be free. And if you don't have children, you teach your friends, you teach your significant other or your mate. You begin teaching each other and conversing and getting connected to how to be free. That's what I'm talking about, how you become free.
Mm.
And what I've told you, everything I've told you tonight, are directions toward becoming free.
Now, what does freedom ultimately, is freedom the peace and ease with the universe and our total connection to this invisible world? Is that what you say freedom is?
Yes, freedom is you're making a movement towards a unitive experience with the source, whatever you want
right.
to call that source. You're moving toward a unitive experience to become one with that source.
With
so
the source, that's... So the invisible
yes.
world then can actually become visible, and we can actually take our physical body to these worlds. Isn't that true?
Yes, you can. And you know what? In one of the ways that you do it to make this unitive experience is through the imagery that we talked about earlier. That's a way of traveling inwardly to make connection with the source, and your body has to follow suit because.
Mm-hmm.
We're a mind, we're a mental, physical union. We're an essence existence union. So
right.
in our vertical ascent, we are making connection to the essence of our existence and meeting the great exchange being. We're making an ascent to meet that source.
Right, which is the essence of who we are.
Encased by a body, by a physical time-space entity called a physical body. And that and that body follows suit. If we're doing it the way I'm talking about, when we reverse our physiology, that body follows suit. And it stays and it stays alive. It stays in movement. It begins to take part in the great infusion of life energies that are available to us from the invisible reality. That's a spiritual point. So we become an open system rather than a closed system that's subject to decay and decomposition or entropy. All closed systems are liable to that, but we're becoming an open system in which we radiate, and we're not liable to entropic possibility.
Chinese say everything comes from nothing. Therefore, we're being fed constantly by this creative force of the universe.
So therefore, we're taking the infusions that are coming to us, and we can only do that if we permit ourselves to become an open system and not fall into the traps, some of which I outlined tonight, by running into the future, by misconceiving emergency, by getting involved in emergency states, by making up stories like that about what's going to happen to us, and by being open to the to our vertical connection.
Right, and this is all, it's a great teaching. I think it would be also interesting to note that I don't think you were into any of this until you had your epiphany when you met your teacher. Can you describe who you were before that and what happened?
Well, I mean, my identifications were, you know, in a normative sense. I mean, I became a medical doctor and a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst. And I practiced along the systems of cause and effect and determinism, you know, the material worldview. So I was caught up in the material worldview, although I had some inclination toward a causal, non-material worldview. There was something in me that was interested in that.
But you didn't have any direct experience of it.
No, I mean, I practiced yoga and I sat in yoga meditation and I was interested. I read a bit on Tibetan Buddhism. I was interested in such things like that. And then my work in psychoanalysis, I became quite interested in the mind. I was always interested in the mind, really. Mm-hmm. And then when I met my teacher, Colette, in 1974, I had an epiphanous experience, and my whole life changed. I went really the other direction. I became really a devotee of the spiritual practice of Western spirituality.
Tell us what happened when you met your teacher, because it's a great story how you just sort of, like, everything disappeared. Tell that again.
Well, when I was in Jerusalem, I was there on a mission having to do with a journal that I had just co-founded called the Journal of Psychiatry and Law. And I went over there to visit a professor in the psychiatry department, who's the head of the department. His specialty was psychiatry and law. And so I got a invitation to come over and study there with him, and I got an apartment and so on. And during the course of my stay there, I found with my ex-wife a Zen center in which we could sit in meditation. We were doing yoga meditation, so we found the Zen center was advertised, and we went and started sitting in the Zen. And as we came back to town, each day from the Mount of Olives, we came back with a young man who was sitting with us, and he said that he wanted to know what my ex-wife was doing. She was writing an article for a magazine. And what was I doing? I was a psychoanalyst. And he said, I did that for 3 years, 5 days a week in Paris, and I got nothing from it. It didn't really handle my issues. But here I met somebody in just recently, and in 4 sessions, everything that I was looking for in the analysis had been taken care of. Mm-hmm. So I asked him, what was that you did? And he said, I did mental imagery, a process called waking dream. And I was, in a sense, open-minded and scoffing at the same time. How could it happen so fast? Because I knew that analysis took so long. And he said, essentially, would you like to meet her?
Uh-huh.
And I met her. He made an arrangement for my ex-wife and I to meet. And when I came there, she interviewed me, and she asked me what I did, and I said I was a psychoanalyst, and I understood you worked with this young man, and he got rid of everything in such a short period of time by something called mental imagery or waking dream. I never heard of that. And then I had a sudden insight, a sudden flash, that Freud wrote an article in 1912 defining for young analysts how to begin your analytic practice, how to begin with a patient. And he said to tell the patient to imagine that you are on a train together and that he's looking out the window and telling you what he sees. So he gave the rule, the fundamental rule of free association, which is the basis of analytic work, that say whatever comes to your mind without editing and without inhibition and everything. He gave it in the form of an image. I myself was quite surprised by this insight because I had, previous to seeing her, I had written an article on the fundamental rule, which was subsequently published in an analytic journal, which had nothing to do with this understanding.
Right.
And so she said to me in a paradoxical way, in what direction does a train go? And I was stunned by that response because it had nothing to do with what I just said, apparently.
Right.
So I became quite, I became a bit agitated, and I was nervous, and I was, you know, rumbling around in my seat, and I was grabbing the arms, and I was sweating. She needed an answer. What was this, a trick question? What does she mean by that? And I'm thinking about all the trains that I've ever been on, and they go in a certain direction. But then in Machu Picchu, I begin thinking that they go up, and in the Alps, they go up. And I'm in a quandary now. Now I'm confused what to do, but I have to give her an answer because she's waiting, and I must. And I'm sitting back in my chair, and my body is rigid. And I finally have to respond. So I took the medical route, which is to say, to hedge your bets, not infrequently, most often, trains go like, and then I made a horizontal movement with my arm. They go in this direction. I felt quite relieved that I had expressed my emergency state. I had fallen into an emergency state, and I got rid of the toxins by making that gesture. I got I did something.
And right, you did something to just get out of
the spell, the tension that was growing, the anxiety and everything, and I was being evaluated. I was worried about being judged. All kinds of things were going on like that.
Right.
Which happens to most of us most of the time. We're always concerned how the world is looking at us. And we're determined
how people are judging us. Exactly. So we were coming from that place.
From an anti-spiritual place. And I said, the trains go like this, and I made this horizontal gesture, and she looked at me for a moment, and then she lifted her arm vertically, and she said, and if we change the axis, and she put it in a vertical direction, and I became light. I had an epiphany.
You became light when she put her arm in a vertical direction?
Right, I had an experience of disappearing, just becoming light. So this Jerry disappeared, and I became light.
How that happened from what she did? What was that connection? I mean,
what can I tell you? I mean that suddenly a whole new door of life was opened to me. A sudden revelation was suddenly made its appearance, and a kind of what I came to understand is that this vertical axis is the axis of freedom. So she was saying,
She showed you the vertical axis, in essence, and you dropped into that space. Would you say
that? So she showed me the possibility of freedom. And I responded by becoming light. And as I returned from light into my body, I had the experience of, I'm no longer an analyst, I'm no longer a psychiatrist, I'm no longer an MD. In the conventional sense, I'm no longer any of that. I gave it all up in that one moment. And she looked at me and she said, it seems you're quite interested in this, aren't you? And I said, you bet. And she said, would you like to learn more?
How long did you stay in that light state? Or you can't tell?
Oh, I can't know. There's no time frame. I have no idea. But I knew when I came out of it that I had to follow this way no matter what. I don't care what the costs were to me. I had to do it because this was the direction of truth. I had experienced it. I experienced it. I had an enlightenment experience. I had to go this way, no matter what would be the consequences, and there were plenty, I can tell you after that, because my I reversed my relationship to the world that I was in. And in that reversing, I went through voluntary suffering. So I went back the next day anyway and started my journey of 9 years of becoming a apprentice to her work. And I went through a period of voluntary suffering. So when I came back, I no longer did analytic work. I lost my referral base. I lost my friends who were connected with the Institute. I lost my family thought I was crazy. I eventually lost my wife. I lost my income. I lost my everything.
Something else opened up for you in that losing,
well,
right?
Because it was because I voluntarily suffered. I took it upon myself, no matter what, to go this direction, to learn this way, because this was a spiritual initiation, and I was following it no matter what the consequences. That's voluntary suffering. That's a true spiritual practice.
I think that's a big point. I'm getting something for myself about that. It's about sacrificing the immediacy for something greater.
So you sacrifice what's of value to you for something of greater value. The word sacrifice means to make holy. Holy, fiche, make. You're making holy. You're sacrificing something in the immediacy of the moment of value for something of greater value. On a vertical level, that's a sacrifice. So I sacrificed all of that. I was giving up what I thought was precious for something that I thought was more precious.
Right.
And whatever it took, and that's voluntary suffering. That's what one must do to undertake spiritual practice of any sort. I don't care what the tradition is. You have to go through voluntary suffering.
I think, but people are so confused as to what is the higher value that they don't know, and they're after immediate reward.
Because what they do is they go through, they become spiritual materialists, and they want to hold on to their material life while coating themselves with a gloss of spiritual something or other. So this is they call themselves spiritual, but they haven't gone through voluntary suffering. They haven't given up and renounced what has been precious to them, really. They haven't really given it up. They hold on to it, and then they want to graft onto it some sort of spiritual practice or understanding. So that's a death impulse, because they're trying to serve two masters at the same time. And that's an impulse. They're fooling themselves, and it's a deception, and they have to suffer, and they'll keep going through the involuntary suffering that comes with that. Because once you're attached to material life, you have to engage involuntary suffering. Material life will always bring with it involuntary sufferings. You see everybody going around now who've had this habitual connection to the material world, believing that the material world gives you safety, certainty, assuredness, and security. And it's a bunch of malarkey. It doesn't at all. And you can see in your everyday life that it doesn't provide it whatsoever. And this is a blatant effect of that. It's a blatant comment on that you put yourself into a position of defining your life by what you own and what you have.
Right.
Which
and that, of course, creates the ultimate, suffering.
Emergency state. And it can be removed in the twinkling of an eye. In the twinkling of an eye, like the Bernard Madoff stuff. $50 billion, people lost their life savings in the twinkling of an eye, just like that.
And the other thing, though, can be given to you in a twinkling if you realize
it comes in the twinkling of an eye, one way or the other. So I'd rather put my stock into the vertical reality than put my stock in the princes of this world. That's my choice. That's what I learned in that epiphanous experience. I was going that direction.
I think that's really valuable. I think it's the value of discipline is what you're saying. I mean, discipline and spiritual practice may seem like suffering.
Discipline means wearing a hair shirt. That's what it means. Going through voluntary suffering, becoming a disciple. And what that means, discipleship, is wearing a hair shirt, being uncomfortable, but you voluntarily put yourself in that position. That's what you do.
In order to be free, you
have to go through these growing pains and bear and endure what's necessary when you're detaching from those attachments that you've held dear and precious.
So that's the power of consciousness itself, is to put the human experience in these situations that will start to strengthen its connection to the vertical source,
to the divine source, and that's power is freedom, used in a beneficial, productive way for yourself. So
that
you become your own. You become your own authority.
So how do we know what disciplines we should do?
Well, if you come to my school and you learn what I have to teach, you got to find out all these.
Well, part of it, I mean, for people who don't go to school or aren't in New York, I think just looking at their addictions.
Well,
and by voluntary giving up the addiction, which is suffering, they'll gain something bigger.
Right. You can renounce, if you wish, fear. You can renounce it. You can say, no, I choose love. But if you look at my website, I got tons of material on there for people to follow.
And your website is drjerryepstein.org.
Yes.
And
drjerryepstein. And if you want to contact me, you can reach me at 212-369-4080, and I'm always available. So always have a possibility of making connection.
Thank you, Jerry. I really appreciate all the wisdom and work and discipline you've done on your own life.
I've gone through a lot. I paid my dues. I know what it takes. Mm-hmm. And so I know when people are fooling themselves, like the spiritual materialists are doing all the time, and become the spokespeople in the media for taking on a spiritual life, which is really a spiritual materialism, where you don't want to give up.
Well, what do you exactly mean by that? I don't have to name people, but like, what would be a spiritual materialistic point of view?
That you are still attached to acquiring goods, to acquiring things. You're still attached to acquisitions. You're attached to the greed factor, wanting more, better, and different.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, wanting to be a meditative practitioner sit in silence and so on.
So you can't serve both masters like you said before.
You can't serve two masters at the same time. Mm-hmm. It isn't possible.
Thank you so much. We're going to go into greater depth, especially with Leonard Orr, on Thursday night, December 18th. That'll be at 330 West 38th Street, room 1500. That's on the 15th floor of the One Spirit Living Alliance.
At 7:30.
Yes. $20 at the door.
$20 at the door. We look very much forward to everybody coming. And,
Thank you, Jerry. I think it's going to be a very interesting conversation with Leonard, who's also done a lot of discipline. He started rebirthing.
I look forward to getting no remuneration.
No remuneration.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well,
we do it as a service. Just like tonight, it's a service.
Yeah, no, I think you're doing a great service. And in this conversation, I actually understood a little more of your basic philosophy. So thank you.
That's very nice. Thanks.
I've been talking to Dr. Jerry Epstein, who is the author of Kabbalah of Peace.
Healing is Immortality, Healing Visualizations, Creating Health Through Imagery. That's always available. You can get it at Bantam. All these other things you can get online from me. Natural Laws of Self-Healing. The Phoenix Process, 1 minute a day to health, longevity, and well-being, and many things you can find.
And there'll be another conference next year. I'll tell people about that. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, email me at newrealities@earthlinks.net. Maybe we'll see you Thursday night, December 18th, 2008, at One Spirit, 330 West 38th Street, room 1500, 730. Check my website, newrealities.com. And I'm going to end with this song here by Chris Williamson. It's the Song of the Soul. Thank you, Dr. Jerry Epstein.
Thank you for having me, Alan. It's been a pleasure.